Greetings and bibulatory ejaculations, my proto-narically chloritinous listeners, and welcome to this March 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this sadly maniacal science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, how about the not-so-idiot scientists of the month? This may not be as popular a feature as idiot scientists, but hey, let's try it out for at least this month. So, as a direct response to the now infamous geneticist, Dr. He of China, Dr. Eric Lander and a group of other eminent biologists have gotten together to push for a 5-year global ban on gene-edited babies. In the March 14th edition of the journal Nature, Lander and a bunch of other famous scientists made their thoughts quite clear on the subject of messing with the human genome when we were still so early in our understanding of what exactly we are doing. 18 researchers in total called for a temporary ban on creating gene-edited babies. They said specifically, quote, "We call for a global moratorium on all clinical uses of human germline editing. That is, changing heritable DNA in sperm, eggs, or embryos to make genetically modified children," unquote. Among the document's signatories are CRISPR pioneers Dr. Feng Zhang of the Broad Institute of MIT and Dr. Emmanuel Charpentier of the Max Planck Unit for the Science of Pathogens in Berlin. Sadly, no, I wasn't asked, but then again, my work has absolutely nothing to do with humans. The proposed moratorium would last about 5 years to give time for public education and debate about experiments. The delay would buy time for scientists to further test and further refine CRISPR-Cas9 and other gene editing tools to make them safer. The moratorium would also be voluntary, with each country pledging individually not to allow clinical trials for creating gene-edited children. Countries would make independent decisions on how long such a ban would last. These researchers are not angels, by the way. We are not proposing a complete ban of everything having to do with manipulating human genetics. Gene editing of embryos, eggs, and sperm would still be allowed for research purposes, but those then couldn't be implanted in a woman's uterus to establish pregnancy. Also, researchers could still use CRISPR-Cas9 and other gene editors to treat genetic diseases in adults and children, provided that any changes to those people's DNA couldn't be passed on to the next generation. There have previously been admonitions like these, but those ethical previous agreements didn't stop Jian Kuihe from editing DNA in embryos that resulted in the birth of those two babies last year. Perhaps this moratorium thing will work out a little better. Molecular geneticist Dr. Paul Berg of Stanford University School of Medicine is another scientist who helped author the proposal. He admits the new call is mostly a matter of semantics, but argues that the word choice does matter. That is, using the word moratorium. Berg says, quote, "If everyone is saying it would be irresponsible to do it, then why not be explicit and say it should not be done at all?" Unquote. Heads of the U.S. National Academies of Sciences and Medicine in Washington, D.C., the U.S. National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and the Royal Society of Science in London published letters in support of the idea in the same issue of Nature. Other scientists say they support the proposed moratorium, but aren't sure it will stop rogue scientists from copying Dr. He's rather stupid actions. Dr. Stephen Guttinger, a philosopher of biology at the London School of Economics and Political Science, has stated, quote, "There's no harm in using the word moratorium. However, let's be clear. I don't think someone will say, oh, someone used the word moratorium. I really can't do that now." Unquote. Another signer of the Nature document, Dr. Russell Altman from Stanford University, says it may be easier now to get a moratorium to stick after Dr. He's breach. Quote, "It will be harder for researchers who violate the ban to find a harbor of safety. Now a ban will have a bigger weight of scientific credibility and would be more likely to be obeyed. A moratorium, if countries agree to it, would have the force of moral authority, even if it doesn't have legal weight, unquote. Okay, let's get on to our actual first news story of the evening. What is the fastest accelerating land animal on Earth? If you said a cheetah, you'd be wrong, although a cheetah is fast at 112 kilometers per hour. Its acceleration is only about 13 meters per second squared. So unfortunately, true believers, you would be wrong for the fastest accelerating animal on Earth. So what is faster then? Well, in an attempt to catch prey, a speed demon spider can launch itself and its web at about 100 times the acceleration of a cheetah. That makes these tiny creatures called slingshot spiders the fastest moving buggers known. This was reported by Dr. Simon Alexander of Georgia Tech on March 4th at the meeting of the American Physical Society in Boston. Found in the Peruvian Amazon, slingshot spiders weave conical webs, and these webs have a single strand attached to the tip of the cone, which the spider reels in to ramp up the tension. When the spider senses a potential meal, it releases the web. The spider and web together zing forward in snaring the prey. Alexander says, quote, just like that, the spider has dinner, unquote. Using portable high-speed cameras to catch the spider's motion, Alexander and his colleagues clocked the spiders at a maximum speed of about 4 meters per second, which is incredible for something so tiny. Alexander says, quote, the slingshot spider's maximum acceleration is over 1,100 meters per second squared. Cheetahs, by comparison, accelerate at about 13 meters per second squared. So that's a stat that puts the fleet-footed cheetah to shame, unquote. All right, well, that was a short story. Next. As regular listeners to the show know, my father has Alzheimer's, and I'm always on the lookout for science stories that may talk about cures or treatments or anything to ameliorate the problem. Usually I'm on the lookout for new drug treatments, but those have been overwhelmingly disappointing lately. That is why the next story, which I'm taking with a big grain of salt, by the way, is so interesting. This is a treatment which does not use any type of pharmaceutical. In the March 14th issue of the journal Cell, Dr. Li Hui Cai of MIT's Picower Institute for Learning and Memory reported that fast clicking sounds can boost brain power in mice with signs of Alzheimer's disease. These external sounds spur a type of brainwave that seems to, quote, sweep disease-related plaques from mice's brains, unquote. Cai found that sounds that hum at a rate of 40 clicks per second, or 40 hertz, seem to spur gamma waves and the clearing of amyloid beta plaques from the hippocampus. The hippocampus is a structure that's important for memory, and usually it's one that's affected by Alzheimer's. A daily hour of fast clicks played by speakers above the mice's cages for 7 days also improved the memories of mice genetically engineered to have signs of Alzheimer's. Compared to mice that heard randomly spaced clicks, mice that listened to 40 hertz clicks were faster in finding a hidden platform in a water maze and better at recognizing an object that they had seen before. Cai says that he still doesn't understand how sound-triggered gamma waves seem to kick off other beneficial changes in the brain. In mice, levels of a harmful form of tau in the brain, another protein implicated in Alzheimer's, dropped, and blood vessels in the brain expanded, perhaps easing the disposal of those amyloid beta plaques. Immune cells called microglia were also bulked up and grew more active and attacked the plaques. When the mice were treated with both flickering lights and clicks, the effect was even stronger, Cai says. The combined treatment led to fewer amyloid beta plaques across a big stretch of the brain, including the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, an area important for complex thinking. What's more, the microglia seem to swarm into a feeding frenzy. Cai says, quote, microglia pile up upon one another, all congregated around the amyloid plaques, unquote. Tsai has co-founded a company called Cognito Therapeutics that is testing the combined light and sound approach in older people with mild to moderate cognitive impairment. He says, quote, "Our studies aren't done yet, but so far we haven't seen any undesirable effects," unquote. I don't know if that's a good thing. I mean, that says nothing at all about beneficial effects, just that it's not hurting anybody. Well, I'll be watching Cognito Therapeutics closely in the future. However, it's going to take quite a bit of convincing from Dr. Tsai that this is not all simply BS to grab better venture capital and NIH dollars for his research. I guess I would feel a bit more sanguine about this type of research if the researcher himself had an idea of how it works at the neurocellular level. Yes, dear listeners, I'm grown more jaded in my old age. Onward and upward to the next story. When I saw my first glacier a couple of years ago in Alaska, I was amazed to see blue ice. Actual blue. Mainly toward the bottom of the glacier, where the weight and mass of the glacier itself was so great it had induced physical changes in the ice and changed its color. And the ice stays blue, even if it's broken away from the glacier and becomes an iceberg. It was not until recently I found out that bright green icebergs can exist as well. I've never seen one of these, and my first thought when I heard about it was, oh, it must be like green polar bears. It's due to algae in the ice? Okay, I was wrong. In fact, I was very wrong. A paper published last month by Dr. Stephen Warren of the University of Washington in the journal Geophysical Research suggests an entirely different source for green ice. So iceberg ice falls into three categories. White, which is what they usually appear, mostly, because light bounces off air bubbles trapped inside the ice, and they look white. They are blue, as I suggested above, and that's the compacted ice. And that is pure ice with all the air bubbles forced out. As I said, this forms on a berg's underside and appears blue because it absorbs light waves, warm colors like red and orange, and it reflects shorter, cooler blue wavelengths. And number three, ta-da, green. These have been known since the 1930s, and they are mysterious, and they have been nicknamed jade bergs. And they've been spotted in and around Antarctica. In the early 1990s, Warren proposed that the green came from microscopic carbon particles from dead organisms. When integrated into ice, these yellow carbon particles would absorb blue light, leaving green to be reflected. Later experiments, though, found that the amount of carbon in green icebergs was so low that it couldn't actually create that emerald hue. Warren says, quote, "So we were left with this disturbing result," unquote. Then in 2016, Warren discovered iron oxides in a decades-old preserved green ice sample taken from the Emery ice shelf in Antarctica. Iron oxides, like rust, reflect reds and oranges, but they absorb blue light. If these particles, possibly picked up from rocks crushed by the weight and friction of glaciers flowing toward the ocean, get incorporated into ice forming underwater, the result would be a vibrant green. And I've seen the pictures, and they really are a bright green. Warren hopes to return to Antarctica to collect samples to see if jade bergs really are rich in iron. If so, that could solve both a mystery and suggest a previously unknown role for this unusual ice, that is, ferrying a scarce but essential nutrient to the microscopic plankton that the entire ocean food web relies on. Warren finishes with, quote, "I don't know how important green icebergs are, but I guess we'll find out," unquote. Next story, singing mice. Well, how about this? Something even weirder. Singing mice doing duets. In the understory of Central American cloud forests, musical mice trill songs to one another. And now a study in the March 1st issue of the journal Science tells of the charismatic creatures and how their brains orchestrate these rapid-fire duets. The paper came from the lab of Dr. Michael Long of New York University and is entitled Motor Cortical Control of Vocal Interaction in Neotropical Singing Mice. In a mouse duet, one mouse's brain directs the patterns of notes that make up songs, while the other mouse's brain coordinates the duet. These duet brain interactions are carried out with split-second precision. Long says, quote, "Our study suggests that a quirky animal from the cloud forest of Costa Rica could give us brand new insight into the rapid give and take in human conversations," unquote. Long adds, quote, "These mice, known as Alston's singing mice, are divas. They require larger terrariums, exercise equipment, and a very special diet, which includes fresh mealworm, dry cat food, fresh fruit, and berries. And they are very vocal. If one starts to sing, it starts a symphony," unquote. The paper suggests that one brain system is thought to control the contents of the songs, but another part, the orofacial motor cortex, or the OMC, orchestrates the split-second timing needed for the mouse duets. When the team cooled the mice's OMC, slowing those nerve cells' activities, songs grew longer, suggesting that the brain region normally controls song timing. And when the researchers used a drug to silence the OMC, the mice had trouble singing duets in response to another mouse's call. This shows in a clear and convincing way that the structure is involved in this behavior. The paper states that, quote, "The singing mice's OMC may not align exactly with the brain areas used to pace human chatter. Still, the results may ultimately yield clues to human conversations, which often proceed at similarly fast clips. That pursuit might ultimately lead to therapies for disorders that affect communication, like strokes and autism," unquote. Okay, so what do these little buggers sound like? Well, here's a recording from Long's lab. You are first going to hear the mouse that starts the duet, and then you will hear the second mouse who is finishing the duet. The singing is a very high-pitched whistle. Do not expect it to be like opera or bird song for that matter. There you go. Like I said, not like birdsong or opera. Okay, the last story of the evening is related to the previous story. It's about singing and our traditional topic, sex. Apparently, it's becoming harder and harder to mate in our noise-polluted society for certain animals that use song to communicate. Just how much this is affecting certain animals is made clear in the new paper in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. It's entitled, Adaptive Changes in Sexual Signaling in Response to Urbanization. The paper came out of the lab of Dr. Walter Hafwerk of the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So Hafwerk has found that Tugara frogs in Panama face a trade-off between, well, sex and death. While males use calls of varying levels of complexity to attract females to mate, these same calls attract the attention of predatory bats and little blood-sucking flies, midges. Over millennia, frogs have evolved strategies to balance this trade-off. But they haven't had millennia to deal with their shrinking habitat. Cities have grown where trees have been harvested, and frogs have had to adapt to these changing conditions. To quantify the differences that Tungara frogs face between life in the forest and life in urban areas, Hafwerk measured light and noise intensity in the two locations. As you would expect, the cities are brighter and the cities are louder. But rather than getting stressed out by city life, the urban frogs are apparently more relaxed. And for good reason. There's fewer bats and fewer midges.
So they've been pretty much released from those two risks of death. And because of that, city frogs can focus on sex. The city frogs call more, produce calls with greater complexity, and continue to call when interrupted by eavesdropping scientists. However, forest frogs clam up if you just look at them funny. Halfwork says, quote, "These changes are not only permissible, but also necessary. The simple calls of forest males don't cut it in the city. Urban females are not impressed. By contrast, forest females swoon over the complex calls of urban males. City males are apparently sexier everywhere," unquote. Remember Aesop's fable of the city mouse and the country mouse? When the country mouse traveled to town with his cousin, he was frightened by dogs and quickly returned to the safety of the country. In reality, country frogs have no such luck. If they travel to the city and then back to the forest, they will find the forest is a greater den of dangers than the city ever was. So, how do city frogs fare when compared to the quiet forest? Surprisingly, you wouldn't have thought, but surprisingly, rather than continuing to shout and then getting eaten, city frogs dial down the complexity of their calls to match the increased risks of the forest. In other words, city living has selected for flexible frogs whose behavior is conditioned by the risk. Halfwerk finishes with, quote, "We do not know whether call flexibility has any downsides to the forest, but if not, we worry that forest frogs may be doomed if increasing urbanization brings Tungara frogs from the forest and the city into more frequent contact. This, unfortunately, seems very likely," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. Keep an eye out for green icebergs. Be glad you're not the prey of the slingshot spider. Keep those mating songs to a minimum volume when out in the country. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.